Greg McBride joins us now, the chief financial analyst at Bankrate, bankrate.com. Happy 5th of July. Greg, how are you today?
Yeah, I'm great. Happy Friday, John. It's great to be with you again.
It's kind of a weird day. It just seems like a Monday, or is it a Saturday? No, it's a Friday. What are the markets doing generally right now? What are you seeing?
Slight up, I guess you might say. I think today kind of a really low volume day. So not a lot of movement in markets. I think one thing of note is, longer-term bond yields are coming back down. The 10-year Treasury note down to 4.28%. It had been knocking on the door of 4.5% a little more than a week ago, and it's come back down, aided by some weaker tone of economic data. This morning's jobs report indicative of a labor market that's cooling, not rolling over, but certainly consistent with that overall theme of slower economic growth ahead.
Well, I was wondering if the uptick in unemployment and the slower jobs numbers is actually good in the long run if you want to see the Fed reduce rates 2 times this year.
If you want to see the Fed cut rates, this was a good jobs report. The precursors or the prerequisites for the Fed being able to cut rates are, inflation needs to cooperate. We need to see continued disinflation, inflation moving closer to that 2% mark. We'll get the consumer price index next Thursday. So I think that's going to be a big one on the economic calendar. But, the jobs report, the labor market's been coming back into better balance. It's, I think, by and large, surprised to the upside. But, we continue to see pretty consistent and pretty decent job growth, all things considered. But the unemployment rate has been ticking higher, and we're now above the 4% mark, 4.1%. That's up from the low of what had been 3.4%. So that's one that's just kind of quietly crept higher. And you're sort of at this point now where if we get some good news on the inflation front this coming week, I think that really almost cements the odds of a September rate cut from the Fed.
It is weird to cheer on an uptick in unemployment, though, and I wonder if that's the best trade, though. Do we want unemployment to go up a little more so as to get interest rates back down a little bit, or should we keep employment as high as humanly possible?
Yeah, I think we want to see employment as high as possible. I think the number we want to see changing is what came out earlier this week with the JOLTS report, the job openings. It actually ticked higher. It went from 7.9 million up to 8.1 million. That's still down from what had been 12 million. But that's a number that needs to continue to come down. There's 6.8 million unemployed workers right now. So there's still 1.2 open jobs for every unemployed worker. Like I said, that's down very significantly, but I think that's the number you want to see come back into better balance. We don't necessarily want to see unemployment go up, although in an economy where interest rates are running as high as they are, where growth is slowing, I think that is to be expected. But that's also why I think there's some urgency for if the Fed gets some inflation numbers they're comfortable with, that they can start cutting interest rates as soon as September.
We're talking to Greg McBride. He's the chief financial analyst at Bankrate, bankrate.com. Let's pause here. I'll put you on hold, Greg, and then we'll come back. I wonder, though, if when we say that unemployment has ticked up a little bit, I don't know if I can put my finger on what is on my mind, but I wonder if that means that some people have lost a job that might be their second or third job. I wonder if this is Americans or jobs that have devolved, and if there's a distinction there. It seems to me like so many people I know are not only working, but are working two jobs to make ends meet. We're talking to Greg McBride on the Wintrust Business Lunch, chief financial analyst over at Bankrate. Greg, I was just asking you to maybe put into some context the unemployment numbers and full employment. I mean, when they say that unemployment went up a little bit, are those people without a job at all, or some people just quitting one of their jobs?
It's those without a job. And I think the number we're seeing, and this is sort of like an early warning indicator, is that it's taking longer to get a job. So, for example, the unemployment rate went up because the number of unemployed people increased by 162,000. But the number of long-term unemployed, those that have been out of work for at least 6 months, increased by 166,000. So it's not that we're seeing an increased pace of job losses, but what we are seeing is an increased pace of those that have been out of work and taking longer to get back to work. On the multiple job holders, no, we really haven't seen much change there. It's been very steady, about a little over 5% of all workers working multiple jobs, and that's not a number that's changed materially at any point this year.
What percentage of Americans are working multiple jobs, did you say?
It's a little over 5% of those that are employed.
Boy, I would have guessed it to be higher than that. Well, I guess that's good news. You also had two numbers that were both below 200,000 in unemployed people, new unemployed people. But the number of job openings increased by over 200,000, right?
Yes, there's two different surveys that comprise the monthly employment report. There's the what's known as the establishment survey, which surveys businesses, and that's where you get the total payrolls number, the increase of 206,000 payrolls. Then there's also the household survey. That's where the unemployment rate comes from, and that's a survey of 60,000 households. In that survey, you saw an increase of the number of You saw an increase in the number of employed. You also saw an increase in the number of unemployed, more people coming back into the labor force, which has been an indicator of the strength of the labor market. But, to your question about are the people that are, is the rise in the unemployment rate due to people leaving multiple jobs, downsizing from two jobs to one? No, it's more of those that are out of work are taking a longer time to find employment again. That's why we see the unemployment rate going up.
Which is higher right now, wages or wage growth or inflation?
Wage growth. And it's been that way for a little over a year now, which is good. Now, household budgets probably aren't feeling a whole lot of relief quite yet. Because if you think of it like a foot race, for so long, for the better part of 2 years, wages were running way ahead. I mean, expenses were running way ahead of wages. They were inflation was going up faster than incomes. And what's happening now is wages are running faster than inflation, but haven't necessarily closed that gap yet. So, households that are continue to feel that budgetary pressure of high household prices, even though inflation, the rate of inflation has moderated, that doesn't mean prices are coming down. It just means they're not going up as fast. Income's going up faster, but it probably hasn't caught up for a lot of households to where those expenses have run over the last several years.
A moment ago, you played for us a scenario where we might see two interest rate cuts this year. If that happens, what happens to markets this year?
I think that's really what's expected in markets at this point. I think that if you continue to see inflation moderate, if you see a cooling of the economy, that so-called soft landing, I mean, that's certainly conducive to the nice run we've had in the equity markets, right? The unemployment rate's still very low. People are working. Money's being spent. 70% of U.S. economic output tied to consumer spending. So, all of that very conducive to the growth in corporate earnings that push stock prices higher. I think the concern and what's not priced in is if we get surprised by something. Does the economy slow faster than expected? Does unemployment come up faster than expected? That would certainly be a recipe for volatility, among other things.
But you're saying the markets have already baked in a rate cut or two, so you don't see a jump, say, in equities, huh?
I think that explains the jump we have seen in equities. Is that we have an environment where inflation is still a little higher than would be desired. But it's moving in the right direction. Labor market is still in pretty solid condition. And that backdrop is such that the economy is strong enough to push corporate profits higher that or it's conducive to higher stock prices, but it's not falling off the table. And if we do get surprised by a sharper than expected downturn, for example, that would certainly be a recipe for volatility in the markets and would quickly unwind the advance we've seen the first half of the year.
Yeah, I know some people are worried about that, but I'm just wondering if there were two rate cuts, would the lower borrowing costs spur more investment? Would we see more businesses expanding or hiring? Would the markets go up still?
Interest rates took the elevator going up, but they're going to take the stairs coming down. So, I mean, you know, interest short-term interest rates are over 5% right now. Two rate cuts. The interest rates are still in the high fours. Benchmark interest rates are still in the high fours. That doesn't really change the picture dramatically. It does lighten the load a little bit. I think maybe on the margin you do see maybe a little bit more corporate investment. But in terms of household borrowing costs, no, it really doesn't materially change that. That home equity line of credit that's in double digits, it's probably still going to be in double digits. That credit card rate that's almost 21%, it's still going to be north of 20%. So, you know, borrowing costs are not going to come down at a rapid pace, certainly not like we saw them increase in 2022 and 2023.
A HELOC, if you can get one, is double digits, huh? I didn't realize that.
Yeah, a lot of them are. I mean, the average rate's around 9%, but I see a lot of lenders with double-digit interest rates. And that's one that, It increased dramatically in 2022 and 2023, and the paradigm has changed. You know, I think for 20 years we got spoiled by low rates, where the idea was you're borrowing against home equity was a real low rate that on an after-tax, after-inflation basis was close to zero. Well, that's not the case anymore with rates in double digits.
Yeah, so if for the people that are waiting for a return to that, are they going to wait for the rest of their lives? I wonder if, I mean, we've been playing with 7% or 6.9% lately for 30-year fixed. I wonder if that's going to be the new reality. It's going to be 6 something. It's going to be high fives. We're not going to see 3 in the time span that people are waiting to get out of their house.
Yeah, we're not going back to that anytime soon. And, well, you know, I'll put it this way. We better hope we're not going back to that anytime soon, because the conditions under which that happened are very bad economically. I think the reality of it is if the economy continues to hang in there, you're high fives in the sixes. I think that's the best approximation of what we see mortgage rates over the course of the next year or so.
Greg McBride is the chief financial analyst at Bankrate. You can read stuff like this at bankrate.com. Greg, you're always very helpful. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, John. Appreciate it.
So our friend Tom Appel isn't laughing so much today. He's the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive, the host of the Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast. You can find his writings and postings at consumerguide.com. And he has a piece here that, if I'm not mistaken, says gas taxes and electric vehicles, hypocrisy, and government incentives. Hi, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Welcome. Or not welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, it's all good. What are you writing about here? I've got the piece in front of me. I know what you're saying, but why is this on your radar today?
Because increasingly there's buzz about how levels of government are going to tax EVs. And the reason for this is pretty simple. Electric vehicles people who own electric vehicles don't purchase gasoline. And gasoline is one of the most taxed things that we can buy in America. In Chicago, for example, the tax on a gallon of gasoline is about $1.70. And if you buy an electric vehicle, you stop paying that money. So even though that the federal government is trying to get you to buy an EV, and they will entice you to do that with a very large federal incentive, the minute you own that vehicle, other levels of government are going to try to figure out how to tax you because they need more money from you.
Yeah. Jump to the chase. Is that a fair trade? I mean, you are using the roads, so the climate notwithstanding, should we ask EV owners to pay a little more?
Well, that's a great question. And you mentioned the climate, and obviously that's why the government wants you to do this. That and it's easier for the auto industry to kind of make the transition if more people do it more quickly. But it probably is fair. And there is a little dark note here about EVs, and that's that they tend to weigh 800 to 1,000 pounds more than comparable gasoline-powered car. So they're pushing down on the road a little bit heavier, and they are, in fact, wearing the road a little bit more quickly. And that's a concern, too.
I guess your first point, though, we need to spend a little more time on, and that is, if we're robbing Peter to pay Paul, then where's the incentive, right? We do want to incentivize people to buy EVs, you know, presuming that the infrastructure will catch up, but we do want to incentivize people to buy EVs, right, Tom?
We absolutely do, and it's good. It works for the industry. It works for the environment. All of it makes sense to incentivize that. And additionally, we've seen, too, that incentivizing EVs has brought industry to the U.S. A lot of foreign car makers, or I should say battery makers, are building factories in the U.S., which is great for employment. So there's a lot of good that comes from purchasing an EV, and you understand entirely why the federal government would want to incentivize that. But you also understand how other levels of government would be like, where's my money going?
And I can't imagine, though, a Chicago City Councilman or an Illinois state legislator saying, hey, let's not tax EVs and collect revenue. Their heavy cars are rolling down the roads because the federal government is incentivizing these people to buy the cars. So let's not kill that incentive. That's just not the way a state or local government would work.
No, absolutely not. They're just losing money on the deal, and they're going to want that money back.
Okay. All right. So which side are you on?
I suppose I'm on both. I wish that, I use the word government in quotes a lot in this article simply because there isn't a single government, and the government doesn't work in lockstep with other levels of government. But I wish there was some sort of grace period for EV owners where they didn't have to worry about this. One of the things that's happening initially is that there are now 16 states that have doubled the registration fee on an EV to make up some of that money. It's not a lot, but like Washington State has tripled their registration fee. So we see where this is starting. And it's just going to increase from there. There's a lot of talk about like an electricity tax, which would be very hard on EV owners.
Yeah. So this hypocrisy that you're writing about isn't one unit per se, but the system overall. One guy says, we're going to help you out. And the other guy says, hey, if you're going to help him out, let's punish him a little bit. You do have a couple of tax facts. There are 6,963 taxing bodies in Illinois. No state has more. You wrote, as an Illinois resident, I'd love to know what the Salt Creek Park District is, as there is no town of Salt Creek, though there is a Salt Creek. It seems to me whatever parks are handled by the institution could simply be managed by the municipalities in which they exist. Call me crazy, right? But I digress. Yeah, once something has a name, then it gets to tax you, doesn't it?
Seems so, yes.
Talk to me just a little bit about the infrastructure, though. I mean, that is the stumbling block these days for EVs, right?
It is. I think it's almost more psychological than real, because most people, at this point, people who own EVs do 80% of their charging at home. So the infrastructure is less important than I think we make it. But it doesn't matter. The reality is the reality. If people think they need it, then it needs to be there. And the big money that went into this as part of the Inflation Reduction Act, which is, a year and a half ago now, one of the components of that was NEVI, which was the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. $5 billion allotted for charging stations. And it has taken a very long time for this to ramp up. But part of the reason for that is each state had to submit a plan to get the money, and these plans were fairly elaborate, including a charging station at least every 50 miles on the interstate that runs through that state. So these programs are only getting funded right now, and we should see action actually later this year.
Was it you that told us that the Chinese are making an EV where rather than worrying about charging up the battery, you can pull one out and pop the other one in like you might on a power tool in your garage? Is there such a car as that?
There are a number of cars, and there are a number of Chinese-only makers that are working on it. It's battery swapping, and there is a fairly elaborate network of battery swapping stations in China where you can pull in and have the battery in your car replaced within 5 minutes with a charged battery. This works better in China than here because they tend to sell a lot of the very same vehicles, and manufacturers there are cooperating on the type of vehicle. This would not work well in the U.S. for a number of reasons, because I don't think there are any two cars that use the same battery.
Yeah, right, or phones for that matter. But
right.
Are there Chinese-made EVs in the United States? Would I recognize the bumper on one of those?
There is not yet any Chinese-made EVs in the U.S., and Biden recently just put a 100% tax on imported Chinese EVs, of which there was only going to be one, which was a small Volvo called the EX30. And they're trying to figure out how to build that someplace else because they didn't intend to sell that in the U.S.
I don't know if you have an opinion about this or much insight, but there is the notion out there that we need to put tariffs on imports to this country so as to protect American jobs and prices. But the economists I'm hearing say that if we have tariffs and they're high, it'll do one of two things. It'll either increase the cost of those goods that Americans will buy, and Americans will have to pay more for those goods. It doesn't punish the country or the manufacturer. Or those products don't come to market in the U.S., and those who are here with less competition charge higher prices. Either way, it's inflationary. What do you know about that relative to the car market?
Yeah, it's a complicated situation, and the older I get, the less protectionist I am. But one of the functions of a good tariff, if it actually works, is to kind of offset what's happening in the home nation. If you talk about China, for example, the EVs they build, and in fact all the cars they build, are heavily subsidized, not by their federal government, but by local states and prefectures as well. So to some extent, when they sell vehicles outside of China, and they don't sell any in the U.S., but there are some moving into Western Europe, they are to some extent dumping. They're simply trying to keep their volume up, and that's a big, you know, big financial issue on a global scale. But as much as possible, probably tariffs should be as low as possible. And we have the nice zero tariff between Mexico and the U.S. and Canada, and just a 2.5% tariff between Western Europe and Japan and the U.S. And those seem to work very well.
It's 12:45. We're talking to Tom Appel. He knows about cars and EVs these days. He's the publisher of the Consumer Guide Automotive, and he's the host of Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast. Tom Appel on the Wintrust Business Lunch today from Consumer Guide Automotive, talking about EVs. And the launch point for this conversation was the sort of hypocrisy that government, quote unquote, puts on EV owners. That is, we give you a discount if you're going to buy them, but then we try and find more ways to tax them because, well, we're losing revenue and those heavy cars are hard on the roads. This texter says, EVs versus RVs, guys. Why do we allow gas-guzzling EVs and fifth wheels to drive across America to pretend camp? That's somebody that doesn't like those big vehicles. I don't suppose there's any electric motorhomes or RVs out there, Tom?
I'm not aware of any electric motorhomes yet, but there's certainly people towing motorhomes with electric vehicles, probably not a lot of them yet. But it's a thing that will gain popularity because there are electric pickup trucks now.
This one says, hey, can you believe, John, Chinese are significantly ahead of the USA in EV industry? I don't know if that's sarcastic or not. I don't think I'm surprised by the Chinese being competitive in anything. What do you make of that text message, Tom?
It's an interesting situation. China only became sort of car aware 20 years ago. We've been buying cars in the U.S. for 100 years, where the Chinese population really didn't get into vehicles until 20, 25 years ago. So it made sense that they would sort of start with electric vehicles anyway, because that's where they were in the development cycle. So they were ahead in building them, and they do have more infrastructure to build them. The problem is actually that they now have overcapacity, which is why we're talking about Chinese imports so much. The Chinese are building more electric cars than they need, and they need to keep those factories running or they become a liability. So they're trying to push them into Russia, where they can do that easily, and Western Europe, and then into Africa as well. And there's talk about how they're going to sneak into the U.S. by building cars in Mexico, which is a very real threat, but not imminent.
What brand do you like out there? What's a good car dollar for dollar? Hybrid, gas, EV? What's a smart buy these days, Tom?
A lot of people talk about the hybrid situation, and hybrid sales are way up, but I don't think that that's a consumer decision as much as it is availability. There's just a lot of good hybrid products out there. But I really like the hybrid products from Honda and Toyota, and I especially like the Honda Accord. If you're still looking for a sedan, it's a fantastic vehicle. It's available standard with a hybrid engine on some trim levels, and you can get 40 miles per gallon all day.
What about the Teslas? What's the world or the market saying about those?
Tesla had its second straight quarter of declining sales, which is really interesting. The bloom is definitely off that rose. And part of the problem for Tesla is that there's just so much competition now in the EV world and that they haven't really updated their products. So if you have a Tesla Model Y that's 4 years old, there's no reason for you to trade it in because the current Model Y isn't much different. So there's a couple things that they need to do in a relative hurry, and that's to freshen their lineup, probably. And then they need a product that's probably falls into a segment that's a little more popular than the ones that they have cars in right now.
I talked to somebody the other day who bought a used Tesla, and they were very happy with it. Is there a used EV market out there?
The used market fell apart recently because Tesla lowered its prices to try to maintain its market share. And then all of a sudden, all the vehicles in the used segment kind of fell apart because it was so cheap to buy a new Tesla. There is a used market out there. Right now, used electric vehicles cost about parity with used gasoline-powered vehicles. So if you're thinking about experimenting with an EV, used is a great way to go.
What's a pickup truck you like these days?
I just drove the Ram 1500 in the tungsten trim level. The Ram was just redesigned. Tungsten's a new ridiculously high-end trim level that most people won't buy. The vehicle came to about 90 grand, but it is a legitimate luxury vehicle that can still do all the pickup truck stuff. Hard not to be impressed, and you can buy a Ram for much, much less than that money.
Yeah. Pickup trucks are just flat-out expensive anyway. I was in the market for one a year or two ago, and granted, it was during the pandemic, and vehicles, new or used, were hard to come by, but I was amazed how those held value.
Yeah, big pickups and mid-sized pickups, too. Try to buy, like, a Toyota Tacoma, their compact pickup. It's impossible to buy one of those for anything that seems like a reasonable price. Now, they do have a reputation for reliability, and you will maintain that resale value when you try to sell it, but it's a lot of money to get in.
Tom Appel is the publisher of Consumer Guide Automotive. Listen for his Consumer Guide Car Stuff podcast, and you can read his writing at consumerguide.com. Okay, Tom, as always, we sure appreciate you coming on.
Oh, thank you, John. Have a great weekend.